Committee on Education will come to order. Welcome. This afternoon, we have a number of bills on our agenda today, and we are going to go out of order. We are going to start with House Bill 2586 before moving on to the other bills. And colleagues, I want to make sure to alert you to an email that you should have gotten in your email boxes last week. Please be sure that you mark on your calendar next Tuesday, April 7th, for an evening public hearing, which will start at 5:30 p.m. Do we have a hearing room for that yet?
Madam Chair, right now it's tentatively set for 50. We're putting the final touches on, making sure that's where we're actually going to be. So,
thank you. So please check your calendars, and I hope you can all plan to be there for that meeting. And we will now open a public hearing on House Bill 2586. Representative Buckley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, I'm Representative Peter Buckley, representing South Jackson County in the legislature, and I am here to just briefly thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee, for taking House Bill 2586 under consideration. House Bill 2586 focuses on school librarians in our K-12 system, and every person that we've talked to about this bill has been very enthusiastic about it because it's for school librarians. We all treasure our school librarians, but it's one thing, I think, to say that we treasure the services and the talents offered by school librarians, but we actually have to take action. We actually have to work to make sure that every school in our state has a school librarian, vital for our kids' education. And I'm not going to take a lot of your time because there are other folks here to testify on this bill, and they have their testimony very well organized. In fact, their entire effort in terms of lobbying the bill, people have been very well organized, and that was commented by one of my colleagues to my legislative assistant in kind of a sense of awe. It's like, wow, they're so organized. And my legislative assistant's response was, yes, they're librarians. So with that, Madam Chair and members of the committee, I just again want to thank you for your time and consideration on this bill. I look forward to working with you. If you need to work any part of the bill, I'd be happy to work with you. We think it's a solid bill, a good approach to making a step forward in the effort I believe we all share to have a school librarian in each elementary school in the state of Oregon. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative. Are there any questions for Representative Buckley? No, seeing no questions. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And before we move on to testimony on House Bill 2586, I am also going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2012 and House Bill 2013, and would invite Senator Devlin forward. And colleagues, we will be reopening 2012 and 2013 again at 1:30 when the speaker will be coming to speak with us about these bills as well.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Thank you for this opportunity to speak about these two bills. I believe these two bills are two very important bills. The first one that would actually allocate a portion of lottery proceeds should our estimates actually be lower than what they actually end up being in reality, I think is a good bill in the sense of potentially putting some dollars aside to start looking clearly at this issue in terms of capital construction and schools. However, given our current economic climate, my guess is, should our estimates be low on lottery, which we will be back in this building sometime in the near future, and if our estimates end up being low, we will probably be in a situation of wanting to use the money for a lot of things, and there will probably be a lot of people in line. But still, I think that bill is very well intended. The other bill, HB 2013, is a bill for a task force, and nobody likes task forces. But particularly since many times bills start off being very large policy issues and then they become task forces. This bill is starting off being a task force, and I think there is a very good reason for that. The reason is, while the problem is of enormous magnitude, the issues over the physical status of our schools and all of our districts in terms of capital construction needs, whether it's for renovation, replacement, or additional capacity, is something that we can talk about, but we really do not have the numbers. We really do not have a very clear picture of what our situation is. Without even having the numbers, we know that our situation is quite dire. The Department of Education, I think you can even still find it on the website, used to maintain a listing of school facilities. It was surprising how high of a percentage of those were more than 50 years old. Many of those buildings are crumbling. I think the Department of Education felt that unless it could actually do something more with the list, it was relatively meaningless. And also, you don't know even if a school is 70 years old or 60 years old unless you keep tracking it. You do not know if it's been renovated. And I think that there is just a necessity, a clear necessity, to understand this public issue. Not as if the only way to solve this is a state solution, because sometimes issues are solved between the state and local districts. Sometimes it's a question of tools, what tools are available to a local district. Sometimes it's a question of shared responsibility. But the magnitude of the issue cannot be denied. It is a significant issue that we can no longer put on the back burner, that we can no longer fail to look in detail, so that we can just understand to the depth of the magnitude of this issue and start to talk about solutions to it. Everyone here that's familiar with their school districts, and I would say that's probably every representative or senator in the building, many of them are familiar with school districts other than their own, know that there's a tremendous backlog of deferred maintenance. Know that many are in need of renovation. Obviously, there are seismic needs for many buildings. They also know that there are a lot of issues surrounding this. There's issues of equity. Obviously, there are school districts that have passed major bond measures, some at unbelievable levels. I'm looking at Representative Thatcher here, who I believe has at least a portion of Salem-Keizer. No one would have ever even thought, I hate to say it that way, that a bond measure of that size would pass in this school district anytime, but it did. It's about 300, my memory is correct?
It was big.
Yeah, very big. And that's true actually in a lot of areas of the state. Many times when people have had histories of not passing bond measures in the last 20, 30 years, that has changed in the last 10, because there's a lot of areas where people have not passed bond measures before, where I think people are seeing the gravity of the situation and are starting to take action there. So I don't think this should necessarily be looked at as some future huge obligation of the state. Obviously, the quality of the buildings and the safety of those buildings for Oregon school children is something we should all be concerned about. The speaker asked me to sign on to these two bills as a chief co-sponsor, which I was glad to do. And I feel kind of a dichotomy in this, because in a different vein, I'm in this building probably telling people, I know that school budget issues in terms of capital are big issues, but quite honestly, with the operating issues that we have and with our own capital needs at the state level, we don't have the dollars to actually address that issue at this time. But I think that this bill, 2013, is particularly a very good step in the right direction. So we start to get a very clear understanding of just how big the issue is, so that we can start to more clearly communicate to Oregonians what our options are in the future and clearly indicate why we believe something needs to be done. And I guess thank you very much, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I'm only the opening act. The speaker will be back here in about 20 minutes.
Thank you, Senator. Are there any questions for Senator Devlin? Representative Maurer.
Thanks, Madam Chair. Senator, two questions. Actually, first is a comment. When the stimulus package was being talked about late last year, I was involved with our school districts, and a lot of it had to do with renovations, remodeling, and school facilities, and it became clear very early that there's nobody in this state that deals with facilities, educational facilities, on a statewide basis. And so clearly somebody needs to be having the conversation at the state level about what districts need. But my question specifically is to get the answers that are asked, like architectural status, mechanical status, structural status, it costs money. And so what I don't want to see is an engineer can write a really good report walking around the outside of the building, but that doesn't give me a whole lot of information. And so I would hope that we're not essentially setting up an unfunded mandate for the districts, and that there's very, very little you can do without some significant engineering work. involved.
My understanding in that type of situation, and we know that should this task force be funded, that it's going to be funded at a fairly modest level, is we will start to determine some of those issues. Obviously, there are school districts that have already done a lot of that analysis that know the issues that are in their buildings. And I think what part of the reporting back is probably going to be school districts that say that we need resources to be able to do that analysis. Because as you know, if you're dealing with a 70-year-old building, you probably don't, you may be able to see some things on the exterior, you may be able to see some things on the interior, but you're really not going to know the structural soundness of that building until you've had a real analysis done of it. So I think that's going to be part of the feedback that you get, that there needs to be more work done. So I'm not expecting this to be perfect, but over my 13 years in the legislature, our common way of dealing with this is to say, oh, this is a big issue. It's bigger than we can actually deal with, but we know it's out there. We should actually try to get more details about how significant the issue is, but we've never taken that next step, and I think that this is that first next step.
Thank you. Representative Springer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Senator, for bringing this bill. Certainly a need that we need to be looking at in our districts, and coming from a school board that had just, prior to my arrival, passed a bond. I notice here on lines 13 through 15, it talks about the makeup of this task force, and it says two school facility managers, one of whom represents a district under 10,000 students, and one of whom represents a district with over 10,000 students, and one that represents a district under 1,000 students. Now, my information is anecdotal, and maybe you have some statistics that speaks to this, but I guess the question pops out at me when I look at that. The majority of the districts in our state are in between those two brackets. So can you give me some thought behind that decision-making process there?
Well, actually, I believe the speaker could probably give you a better indication there. But the reality, I would believe, would be a little bit different from that, because we only have a handful of districts that are the huge districts, the Salem Kaisers, the Beavertons, the Portlands.
Right.
Eugene-Springfield, if they were one district, would be a similar district, but they're two districts.
Right.
Sometimes in my area, my district, people talk about my districts being average-sized districts. Well, for most of Oregon, they're probably large districts. I mean, one is 14,080 MW, one's about 6,000. The other, I think, is somewhere in between, and obviously I have a little bit of the Portland School District, which is actually still the largest. I would guess that a lot of school districts, most school districts, do follow in between, but they actually fall more towards the 1,000, probably between the 1,000 and 5,000. I mean, the Oregon School Board people are behind me here. I think they could give you a better indication, but a 5,000 ADMW school district is a pretty large district, actually, by state standards. So.
Any further questions for Senator Devlin?
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. So shifting gears back to House Bill 2586, I'd like to invite Mary Giannone, Kelly Kuntz, and Jim Shepke, please. Welcome.
This wasn't the day to lose my voice. I apologize.
And you can pull the microphone closer to you so you don't have to lean forward. There you go.
Chair, Counselor, and members of the committee. My name is Kelly Kuntz, and I appear before you today as an educator for the past 37 years with experience as a school librarian, a classroom teacher, past president of the Oregon Association of School Librarians, and currently as the administrator for instructional technology and library services in Beaverton. But I also come to you today as a grandmother. who wants her beloved Carter to have access to a school library when he enters kindergarten in 2 years. I urge you to support House Bill 2586 with its requirement for school districts to include goals in their continuous improvement programs about their school library programs, and that allows the Oregon Department of Education to award grants for library programs. Given current economic conditions, this represents a first step in guaranteeing that every Oregon student has access to what the International Reading Association identifies as fundamental to student achievement, and that is a school library program that is adequately staffed with both certified and classified supports, with sufficient funding for both print and non-print materials, and is soundly supported by the school's administration and district. There have been, in the last 10 years, 19 states studying the impact of a school library, and that includes Oregon. And they validate a 5 to 10% increase in reading scores when associated with a library program. But what does a library program look like in the year 2009? I invite you to walk into any one of our 50 Beaverton school libraries, and you will see a diverse population of students browsing shelves and selecting materials at their interest, at their reading level, and their ability level. You will see certified teachers working closely with classroom teachers, certified librarians working closely with teachers to extend and enhance activities in the classroom. And I do want to remind you that here in the state of Oregon, school librarians are double certified. They're certified as classroom teachers and as library media specialists with a focus on information literacy. You will also see teams of students competing. They read a wide variety of books, and they compete in regional and statewide competitions. Recently, over 2,000 elementary students and middle school students from Clatsop, Columbia, Tillamook, and Washington counties competed in the Oregon Battle of the Books, and there were 10 teams from middle schools in Beaverton and 19 elementary teams. I was there. I was amazed to see that Jesuit gym filled with enthusiastic students who were readers and their parents. And who says boys don't read? You should have seen the number of boys participating in this event. In a strong library program, you will see librarians working with students how to safely, ethically, and effectively use the Internet. An example of a library activity occurred recently in a third and third grade students were they were invited after a copyright lesson to select a picture off a particular website, and then they were, after a discussion of reliable sources, invited to research information on the web about that picture. And then they recorded why they selected the picture, what they learned in that lesson, in a podcast, which was then shared with their classmates and their parents. It is the school librarian who helps teachers teach and learners learn. And it is the school library that provides equal opportunities for learning and achievement for all students. Classroom teachers do an excellent job of teaching the mechanics of reading, but it is in the library that students practice these skills, select books in their areas of interest, and develop a lifelong passion for discovery and investigation through reading, whether it be in printed format or digital format. Thus, I ask for your support on 2586 for Oregon students and for Mike Carson. Thank you.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jim Shepke. I'm the State Librarian, the Director of the Oregon State Library, and I'm here today to testify in support of House Bill 2586. You have my written testimony, so I can be very brief. The State Library Board strongly supports this bill. 8 years ago, we funded one of the 19 studies that my colleague Kelly Kuntz just referred to, and we proved that here in Oregon, the schools that have good school libraries are the schools that have the highest student achievement. And if any of you are interested in this book, we have it. We have several copies at the State Library. You could check it out. So having done that, we believe that this bill sets us on the right path to have better school library services for all our students in the state. We collect statistics about school libraries in Oregon, and unfortunately in our latest data collection we found that only 46 schools in the entire state currently meet the quality education model standard for school libraries in our schools. Only 46 schools, and 35 of them, by the way, are in Kelly's school district, the Beaverton School District, which really does an outstanding job. Just one other statistic very briefly. In 1980, there were over 800 school librarians in Oregon schools. In the latest year for which we have data, 2007, there were only 454. So our enrollment has gone up considerably since 1980, but the number of school librarians in our schools has gone down. So we, on behalf of the State Library Board, I just want to ask for your support for this bill. We think it's the first step to begin to have improved school library services in Oregon schools. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. I'm Mary Ganane. I'm president of the Oregon Library Association and also youth services manager at Eugene Public Library. Oregon Library Association is a membership organization of library staff and board members from all types of Oregon libraries. We're 1,000 members strong, and we all support the passage of House Bill 2586. I also have submitted written testimony, so I will be brief, too. What I wanted to focus on is that public and academic library staff consider ourselves partners with school libraries and school librarians in serving our common client, who is the student. We all have a role to play in guiding students to know about how to find and use information, whether in a library or outside of a library, whether on the internet or using other resources. The other partners are parents. After reading readiness, groundwork is laid by parents. It is school library staff who can best teach the individual, specific, and discrete elements of information literacy skills that students need to navigate in this 21st century. Public libraries back up those lessons as we're helping children after school with homework help or to find enriching recreational reading. And then academic libraries take the students to the deepest level of information gathering and finding in specialized areas to support their fields of studies. So like any partnership, the whole system is only as strong as the weakest member of the partnership. And as we see have seen school libraries get weaker in this state since Measure 5, since the first round of property tax limitation, we try our best to make up the difference, but we know that students are suffering and, in general, society suffers in this global economy. If our kids are judged not to be able to have the same skills as others. Just to take it to the ground level at a public library, after school I help kids find books. So as I'm walking them toward the fiction area to find, for example, a Beverly Cleary chapter book, I have to be thinking, do they know the word fiction as I say fiction? Do they correlate it with chapter books? Do they know who an author is? Do they know their alphabet when I say these books are alphabetized by author? Do they know then alphabetization that goes after the first letter of the alphabet? And then I'm thinking all of this and walking down an aisle back where the alphabet is backwards, and I'm wondering, do they have the skills to make that correlation? And it really is the school libraries who have the staffing and the time to break all of that down into those little lessons so that as the child goes out into the world and uses public libraries and academic libraries, they will have those lessons to fall back on. So this is a start. This bill is a start toward building the strong school libraries that our students need. And I would say that OLA members around the state stand ready to help school districts as they work on the strong school library component of their continuous improvement plans. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Are there questions for this panel? Representative Springer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you all for your testimony today. In looking at this bill, I see it as being twofold, the first section talking about applying for the grants, and then the second section talks about, and it's a shall, talking about the continuous improvement plan that districts do in many areas, but not this area as of as of yet. And then I meld that with looking at my son's K-8 that has less than 250 students in it. Incredible school, has a media assistant, so it's not had a librarian in it for years and years. So I'm looking through how Chris Louie is going to put together this plan and these goals. So can you talk about the mechanics of that a little bit? Because I know there's elements of bringing community input and stuff. I just want to be, as much as I'm on board here and have committed with that library for the last 5 years in very practical ways, I want to make sure that they receive this as a good thing also. So what are the mechanics of putting that together so they can be successful in this part and not have a stick instead of a carrot in Section 1?
Well, I think clearly we talk about a strong library program. It is not defined. We were filling the lines in, I think, for you to let you know that a strong library program does have to certify. And what this is saying, and I've read a number of those continuous improvement plans from different districts, what it does is shine a spotlight that says to a district, it's important for you to focus. Do you have a library program of any type? Right now, the bill does not define what that is. So we're hoping as an initial step, saying that the library is as important as everything else when you're writing your continuous improvement plan, that will be, and they will show progress toward reaching whatever it is they can do within their district.
Yeah, follow up. So then looking at this language, could that continuous improvement plan as it applies to libraries be as basic and simple and acceptable at a level of 4 years ago I came into the library and I made a comment about the encyclopedias, the newest set of encyclopedias, and yes, they had 15 to 20 year old encyclopedias on the shelf. The newest set was 10 years old, which was ridiculous, and so within a couple months we had a new set of encyclopedias in the library. But she has typically a $300 a year budget, so she doesn't buy encyclopedias. So could the plan be as simple as rotating encyclopedias on a five-year level or something like that? I'm concerned that a school like that, and that's not the smallest of the schools in my district, it's going to be too big for them to get there. Did I make my point clear? Okay.
Yeah. There are standards that exist nationally and that have been adapted at the state level that are scalable, you know, vis-a-vis the size, the square footage of the building or the budget size. That should help in that regard. And then it seems like the QEM also would be helpful if you want to talk about that.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, and Representative Springer, the quality education model is something that the library community thinks is a good standard, and it only requires a half-time librarian in an elementary school, for example. It's not unrealistic. It requires, in an elementary school, a per-student expenditure of $21 a year, which is basically the cost of one book. So I think our hope as librarians is that if this bill were to pass, that many districts would at least look at the quality education model as something they could strive for over a long-term period. And we know that the Portland Public Schools right now, you may have seen the article in the Oregonian a few weeks ago, the Portland Public Schools are actually looking at the quality education model and asking themselves if they could achieve that by 2015, I think. So as a long-term goal, that's what we would hope for.
Thank you.
Representative Van Orman.
Thank you, Chair Gilser. The way that I'm reading it, it's simply adding school library programs to a system that's already in place that school districts can apply for if they so choose. Is that correct? I mean, it's not a requirement that they do that, but they would have the ability to access funds.
Madam Chair and Representative Van Orman, there's two parts to the bill. One is adding the ability for schools to apply for funds in an existing grant program to benefit the school libraries. So
okay.
that is one. And then the other would be the requirement to include planning for strong school libraries in a continuous improvement plan.
Okay.
And my understanding is that is the required part, and the other is optional.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Parker. Thank you, Madam Chair. Sounds good to me. I like the idea, I like libraries, etc. Everything I hear is books. I think there's enough flexibility in here that we're not talking solely about books and paper, correct? And I overspoke a little bit, not everything I'm hearing, but the conversation is focusing a lot on hard copy.
Mm. Well, I did try to, members of the committee and Representative Parker, absolutely, you are absolutely right. And within the school environment, it's the school librarian who is preparing kids to be able, and I talked about ethically and effectively and safely using the internet. That is
right.
How we get our information. I still will stick a book in a kid's hand mm-hmm. every opportunity mm-hmm. I get. Mm-hmm. But absolutely, they have to learn how to read whatever the format is. And we have to offer that in our libraries, and we do.
Okay, great. I would follow up very brief, just a comment. I would love to, as we go forward here and have all these hopes and dreams and limited funds for acquiring, achieving them, that we could figure out ways to bring in some of these kids who are so incredibly facile with the new technology and as assistant librarians or some similar title mm-hmm. as we move forward. Because
yes. mm-hmm.
my son's passed me up.
Hi, Representative Dimbro.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And, you know, actually just following up on that point, I think that underlined the spirit of this and what I think would be reflected in the self-study, the continuous improvement plan, would be not just the infrastructure of the library, but how best to integrate the resources of the library to the other classes, right? How to teach those research skills in all the other classes, how to make it all one system. It's kind of interesting that the bill is written a little backwards, actually. Section 2 should really be Section 1 and Section 1, Section 2. That is, I think the important thing here is that the schools be doing this self-analysis on a regular basis, and doing so, they're probably going to find that their library resources are inadequate, and they're going to apply for a grant, right, which is in Section 1. The self-analysis part is really, really important, I think, and just my own experience is my own direct experiences with accreditation studies, at my college, which happen every 10 years, and we always, a key component of getting reaccredited is looking at your library and how your library is functioning, and I have to tell you that, I think we're always thinking about the library, but we think about the library particularly when we're up for reaccreditation. And so having it be part of that ongoing continuous improvement process, I think is really critical. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Our next panel, let's figure this out. The next panel is Sarah Gander, Diletta Gonzalez, and Stephen Cox, please. Welcome.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Stephen Cox. I'm with Salem-Keizer School District. I'm the Library Media Coordinator, the Program Associate for Libraries in Salem-Keizer. And I have two of our outstanding Library Media people with us today. We have Diletta Gonzalez, and I'll let them introduce themselves, and Sarah Gander.
Hi, Madam Chairperson and members of the committee. I'm Sarah Gander. I'm a library media teacher in Miller Elementary School in Salem-Keizer. And I would like you to know that I do have the best job in the world. In my school, I am the only certified teacher who sees every child in my school every week. I get to watch them start out when they're in kindergarten and they work their way up through fifth grade. I watch them grow as readers. I watch them grow as learners. I get information when I have this one little girl who's from a Vietnamese background going, well, where are the books on my country? And I'm scrambling around looking, what can I do to support her love of her roots, of her family? After the Obama election, I have my interracial children coming up saying, Mrs. Gander, where are our books on President Obama? I have never had elementary kids ask for books on a president as much as I have after this election. Our job is like the most exciting job you can have. It changes every year. It changes with every group of kids we have. It changes with every staff member that we have, because every staff member is going to want to work with us in different ways. I had one teacher that I loved dearly that I finally talked her into doing a collaboration unit this year, and at the end of it she goes, Sarah, is this what you've been talking about all the time? Is this what you want us to do? And I'm like, yeah, and she goes, it's wonderful. You're doing this piece of it, I'm doing this piece of it, and our children are winning from it. I cannot express how lucky I feel to have the job that I have. I am in an elementary school. I'm lucky enough to be at one elementary school. My husband's in a small district in Central Oregon right now, and during the summer, they don't have a librarian there. I went over and spent a couple of weeks kind of helping weed through things, helping them to come up with a plan that they have an assistant who could work on things. And I walked into the library, and I'm looking at it going, why did they set it up this way? And so I started asking people, because I didn't want to offend anybody, and they go, well, we have our hardback fiction books here, then our paperback fiction books here, and then we have our nonfiction hardbacks and our nonfiction paperbacks. And I go, well, how do kids find things? And they kind of looked at me like, well, they just kind of learn things over time. And so we spend a lot of time just getting it into a system that worked for me. I hope it's working for them this year. But as a teacher, we have the background to look at educationally what is the best thing for our kids. Working remotely in someone else's district, where I'm only there a couple of weeks during the summer and kind of whenever I go over there, I don't get to see the kids on a day-to-day basis. I don't get to have the little dimmies coming up saying, where are the books on my country? I don't get to see Naima's face saying, where are the books on people like President Obama who've made a difference in our world? Having me in that building helps me to help them find the resources that they need. And Representative Springer, you talked about your children. I remember, for whatever reason, my daughter loved ancient Egypt. And I was working in the middle school library at that time, and so I could bring home all these books on ancient Egypt. And one day, one of the sixth grade teachers who taught in ancient Egypt was with my daughter and I, and Margaret's talking about ancient Egypt. And she, when Margaret was done, she goes, do you know your daughter knows more about ancient Egypt than my kids do at the end of the unit? And I'm like, well, yeah, because I can bring home stuff for her as she is ready for it. And that is, for children like mine, for children like Deletta's, I'm not worried about our kids. But for the kids who do not have a mom who is a librarian, we need to support them in coming in and finding things that they're interested. Thank you for looking at this bill, and I'm very excited to be in this place of it.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, thank you for having me. My name is Deletta Gonzalez, and I am a librarian here in Salem Kaiser. Actually, I'm Washington Elementary School's librarian. And I actually live in Albany, and Albany School District does not have elementary school librarians. So when she says she's not worried about my son, I am. He will be going into kindergarten in a few years with no elementary school librarians. They have wonderful assistants that do their very best, but it's not the same as having someone there helping them pick out their books and picking out the most appropriate books for them. I'm also a small town girl. I grew up in Eastern Oregon, in Eragon, Oregon. And when I was in Eragon, they had librarians in every school. The elementary school had the most amazing librarian. Middle school was fantastic. High school, she just drew us all in. Unfortunately now, Morrow County, where I grew up, has not one single librarian in their entire school district. And it saddens me because I know that I wouldn't take my child back there to live because there would be no support for their education in the way that I think is important. Umatilla County, who is right next door to Monroe County, has one librarian for every school in their district. As I look at QEM, the quality education model that we were just talking about a few minutes ago with Jim Shepke, I noticed that the elementary staffing levels in this state have decreased immensely. In 2002-2003, there were 198 elementary school librarians for 686 elementary schools. Now, there are 711 elementary schools in this state and only 115 elementary school librarians. Those numbers worry me, and I urge you to support this bill, not just for Salem Kaiser kids that are so blessed to have one of us in every building, but for all the kids in Eastern Oregon, Central Oregon, and all over the state that don't have us. Thank you.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'd like to summarize. I'm fairly due to Salem Kaiser. I came from Washington State, having spent 25 years there as an educator, and came from districts that had library media programs and had people in place, and I originally came from Oregon, from the University of Oregon in the early 80s, and when I left Oregon, there were probably 800 library media specialists, huge state conference, lots of exciting things going on, and when I came back 3 years ago, I was surprised and actually disappointed at kind of what had happened here. In Salem Kaiser, we're very blessed, and you know, we have wonderful library media teachers. But what I'm concerned about is I've traveled around to libraries in our state, and is that I see what I would call hollow shells. When I go into a library now and I look through the eyes of a library media person, I see books on the shelves and I see some computers, but I don't see a comprehensive program for kids. I don't see books that are there for a reason related to the curriculum, computer programs that are related to the curriculum. I don't see a focus that a library media person can bring that's trained as a teacher and certificated. And that concerns me. And as Deletta said, I would be concerned if I had a child in school because they're missing a huge component of school. I see the library media program as the hub of the school, and I see that hub, that home for kids, as deteriorating in a lot of schools, and that concerns me. So, especially in Salem Kaiser, where our focus is on literacy, the library media program is the hub for that literacy program. It's where kids get books, where they learn about reading, where they learn about accessing information and lifelong skills that they're going to take with them the rest of their lives. So, I would ask you to support 2586. I just believe it with all my heart that this is an important bill, an important step for our state and for our kids in the state of Oregon. And thank you for your time today. So,
thank you all very much. Any questions for this panel? Seeing them, thank you very much for coming today.
Thank you so much.
And with that, I will close the hearing on House Bill 2586. And we are still in public hearing on House Bill 2012 and House Bill 2013. Speaker Hunt.
Nice to be back for the Education Committee. For the record, Dave Hunt from Clackamas County. The two bills you have before you, Madam Chair, and members of the committee, are bills that are really part of a multi-session effort that a bipartisan group have had over the last few years to really get our state more focused on K-12 capital construction needs. Historically, we've just left up K-12 capital construction needs to the local district, said, you know, you've got aging facilities, too bad, figure out a way to do with them. You've got high growth districts, too bad, figure out how to do with them. You've got natural disasters, too bad, figure out how to deal with them. And we have the resulting facilities around our state because the state has never really stepped up. If you look in contrast with the state of Washington, for instance, where there's a clear partnership between the state and local districts for facilities, you can see clearly different outcomes in terms of facilities, in terms of the safety and security and usefulness of those facilities. So this, these two bills are intended to be two additional tools in the journey of addressing K-12 capital construction needs. We obviously made a major couple steps forward last session with the passage of the bill allowing local school districts to enact a construction excise tax. We with the passage of the double majority reform that the voters affirmed in November of last year. These are two additional steps. House Bill 2012 in particular should look very familiar to returning legislators because we passed a nearly identical version in 2007. Then it was House Bill 3344. Now, House Bill 3344 in the end was amended down to, so this is the bill that takes surplus lottery dollars. So everything that ends up being generated by the lottery beyond what, in this case, the May 09 forecast would be, when they close out the biennium 25 months later, whatever has been generated in terms of surplus beyond that estimates just for lottery would go over into a capital construction matching account that could be used to help local districts meet their capital construction needs. Historically, the lottery has always generated significant dollars more than the estimate. The one time, of course, that did not happen was this biennium. And so the bill we passed in 2007, then House Bill 3344, would have taken half of those surplus dollars for this biennium once this biennium is over and put those in. And with each revenue forecast, I've watched that lottery estimate just drop and drop and drop, and now it, of course, like everything else, is underwater below the original estimate. This approach would do what actually the original version of 3344 would have done 2 years ago, not just done it one time, but done it permanently each biennium, and not just taken half of that surplus, but taken the entire lottery surplus and put it into this capital construction matching account. And so it would give us a tool to be able, not the complete tool, but give us a tool as a state to be able to help the districts that are hit by natural disasters like Vernonia, to be able to help the districts that are dealing with aging and potentially dangerous facilities, districts like Lowell, to deal with those districts that are dealing with rapidly growing demands on their K-12 schools in so many parts of our state. So it's not a large sum of money. It's not the total answer, but especially when coupled with the tools that we've given districts around the construction excise tax, around double majority reform, I think this is an important tool to enable them to go forward, especially when we get back into what I think will be more normal times and the lottery is again outperforming the estimates that are made at the beginning of the biennium. The nice thing about the money is it's not dollars that we're taking off the top. It's dollars that are materializing beyond the estimates that have come forward. And so it allows us to, when those times are good, to be able to take those dollars off. So you'll see that as a subsequent Ways and Means referral. I would encourage you to approve that and pass that down to Ways and Means. I think that bill makes sense, frankly, regardless of where our other budget discussions end up. In contrast with the second bill, House Bill 2013, which I think is really critically important. It is going to cost some money, and when the work group was developing this during the interim, the cost of this was always clear. The state of the budget being as far down as we are was not as clear a year ago and even 6 months ago, as you all know well. This, I think, I am still hopeful that we'll be able to identify some dollars in the Ways and Means process. Again, I would contrast 2012. I think we should pass out without concern because it won't impact our ability to put together budgets at the end of the day. 2013, I do think we need to hold in Ways and Means until the end of the budget process to make sure that we are considering that alongside other things that do have costs. It was nowhere clearer than in the most recent round of capital construction discussions when we did a stimulus package in February. And we sent out a notice to a whole bunch of entities, give us your projects. And the university system identified a clear set of projects. The community colleges identified a clear set of projects. And ODOT identified a clear set of projects. And state agencies, other state agencies, identified a clear set of projects. And K-12 said, we've got lots of needs, we just don't have a clear assessment of the care project list that's in any way assessed or prioritized. And it really illustrated in a stark way the challenge we've got. Not only a lot of needs out there, but you know, in some districts who have very clearly assessed needs, others which have not, and no clear sense of statewide analysis about where those needs actually are. This kind of a school facilities task force would give us such a focus. And in some ways it's really modeled after the court facilities task force that we appointed in 2007, that then in the beginning of this session brought back recommendations to us for our consideration. I would note that not only will this identify specific needs for facilities, but will also identify the local financial capacity of each district, because obviously the financial capacity varies considerably from district to district around our state, and also recommend funding mechanisms back to us to be able to bridge that gap between local capacity and school facility needs. There have been, unlike the 2012 where I haven't heard any suggested amendments, 2013, we've heard a few suggested amendments, one to add the state treasurer or the state treasurer's appointee to be on there as a non-voting member, a few other potential membership changes to make sure we've got a good cross-section, small districts, mid-sized districts, large districts, urban districts, rural districts, suburban districts, low-growth districts, high-growth districts around the state. And so we are still working, and I would certainly welcome any additional suggestions you have for that. Again, I would encourage you to put 2012 on more of a fast track. I think 2013, by necessity, has to wait until the end of the budget process. And I'm sure Representative Comp and her Ways and Means Subcommittee would be happy to give it a home to rest for a few months until we have a clearer sense of where the rest of the budgets are. I'd be happy to take any questions you may have.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Representative Huffman.
Thank you, Chair Gelser. Speaker Hunt, I apologize if you mentioned this and I missed it, but in 2012, where have the monies at the end of the biennium historically gone? Were they swept into the general fund?
They've actually just been rolled right over into the next biennium for allocation by the next Legislative Assembly.
For any purpose,
I believe, Madam Chair, Representative Huffman, I believe, although others to follow may correct me, I believe they would still have to be spent on something that the lottery is intended for, you know, economic development, education. Obviously, so much of our budget goes to the area of education that it's not like that's usually a problem in the next budget cycle. But I believe it certainly has to be expended on things consistent with the lottery, but there's no specific place it just rolls over into. It doesn't become money for another purpose.
I just want to make sure they weren't dedicated for economic development, that we're stealing from economic development to go to another necessary project. Thank you.
Any further questions for the speaker? Seeing none, thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair.
So next we have David Williams and Chuck Bennett.
Madam Chair, Chuck Bennett with the Confederation of Oregon School Administrators. I just wanted to testify in favor of House Bills 2012 and 2013. Members of the committee, we've worked closely with Speaker Hunt and his work group, as well as with others, and we're involved in developing particularly House Bill 2013. And a great deal of the reasons for this have been, I think, outlined by the Speaker and the Senate Majority Leader. It is an incremental way of addressing school districts' capital needs. We really don't know what the shortfall looks like. I can recall testifying on capital needs at some point during the past several sessions. sort of wondering out loud how big it is. I mean, we can talk in billions of dollars. We know it's in some huge amount. We just don't know how huge the amount is. This would give us a chance to not only identify what the shortfall and capital needs for K-12 looks like, but also to begin to look at it in its component parts and begin to deal with some priorities. And I think the speaker gave a fine illustration of what the problem looks like, what we saw when the request for information for stimulus dollars came down the pike. It was sort of like, what do we do? You know, I mean, you're asking, but nobody has that kind of information on a statewide basis, and certainly not the kind of information being requested in any kind of priority form. We believe 2013 is a really good beginning step. We would ask you to send it to Ways and Means, as the speaker described, to await its place in the final priorities of the session. Thank you.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, David Williams with the Oregon School Boards Association again to support House Bill 2012 and House Bill 2013. Also want to emphasize these the work group that Speaker Hunt pulled together over the interim really looked at a full subset of K-12 capital construction issues, these being two bills in that package. Another bill we've worked on down in House Revenue is a bill that would bring about some amendments to the construction excise tax legislation from last session to make that work a little more smoothly in school districts. And then another bill, HGR 13, which would broaden the definition of capital construction that's currently in the Constitution to allow districts a little more authority when they do issue their local bonds about what those dollars can be spent on. I just want to echo really the biggest point that the speaker made, and that is about really getting a statewide handle on what the facilities needs around the state are. I just printed off before I came over, and I can provide this for the committee, all of the local bond elections going back to May of 2006, so not a huge time horizon there. Of those, 33 districts passed bonds totaling upwards of $2 billion. So I don't think there's any lack of need. But what I think we do need to get a handle on as a state, in our effort to help you hopefully down the road take a more participatory role in funding our K-12 capital projects, is get a sense of what is the disparity of that need, to what degree does that diverge in different areas. You know, we often throw around things like the average age of buildings in the state is over 50 years old, and number of condemned buildings and these types of things, and a lot of it is to be perfectly honest, based on anecdotal data. So I think it really is about time that we step up and really get that kind of statewide approach to this. For House Bill 2013, we would encourage you to approve the policy of the bill and send the bill to Ways and Means, where we can better grapple with the funding mechanics, if you will, in the bill.
Thank you both very much. Any questions? Representative Van Orman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think one of the issues that we raise is the ability at the local level to get anything done. And having two school districts that just passed a couple of bond measures has been a huge challenge. And in Sandy, they're going to get a completely new high school. But in Hood River, we're going to get some things done. But it's a very modest proposal of fixing things, air quality being number one. And because it's based, this property tax is not based on anybody's ability to pay, it makes it very, very difficult to convince people that they should be supportive. So I guess I really don't have a question, because I guess I'm basically making a statement of support based on experience and knowing how challenging it is. But I do believe that the state needs to be involved in this issue.
Thank you.
We certainly agree.
Yeah. Oh, please.
Sorry. Well, we certainly agree with what you're saying. It's one of the, ultimately, one of the real difficulties that districts have faced since passage of Measures 5, 4750, is trying to grapple with the property tax as the primary funding method for capital needs. And Speaker Hunt has been taking us through, again, an incremental solution, we believe, to the problem. We hope we'll arrive at a solution. And this task force, we believe, has the right makeup of members to at least take on the question of state participation, what it would even look like. And you'll hear from folks testifying after us from the School Facility Managers Association, who were really instrumental in helping put this together. They have some experience in other states and how it works, particularly in the state of Washington, where the state does have a role. But right now, it's really up in the air what any of this would look like. And that's probably a good thing, that we go in with pretty much an open mind as to how to deal with funding issues.
Thank you. Any further questions for this panel? Mm-hmm. Representative Harker.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm wondering if there are any unintended negative consequences of this action. And I was thinking, no, absolutely
no,
not.
Okay.
I was wondering this earlier as the speaker was presenting. Oh, follow-up? as the speaker was speaking. And I decided that probably enough thought had gone into this that indeed there, the answer was no. But you made me wonder about it again when you said there was another bill elsewhere thinking about redefining what capital construction is, etc. And I just need to ask, because I wouldn't want to get us into the situation where we're really trying to help out, but because state funds are now involved in Project X, that the constraints on the way the project moves forward are different and, in fact, more limiting than they would have been beforehand. Thoughts?
Madam Chair, Representative Harker, I think first of all, 2013, of course, we're just creating a task force to, mm-hmm. to sort of look at all mm-hmm. of these issues. To my knowledge, there aren't a whole lot more restrictions on the state than there are on school districts. We generally have all of the same sorts of building codes restrictions, et cetera, et cetera. The state, of course, cannot constitutionally incur debt to pay for capital construction. That is another piece of the HDR 13 that I mentioned, actually, and forgot to mention that. But that is another piece of it, is to allow the state to incur debt to pay for capital construction needs, which they cannot currently do. But I think for House Bill 2013, I think the answer would be no. There are not those kinds of interactions that we know of, and hopefully those are the type of things that the task force would be able to flesh out further for us to say, well, this is one area we might want to consider as we put together sort of the funding package for K-12 capital.
Okay, I'm good. Thanks.
Thank you, Representative Norman.
Thank you, Chair Gelser. You've raised a question now. Finally, I have a question. You said the state cannot incur debt for capital construction, and I presume you mean school construction.
Exactly, K-12 capital construction. Yes, excuse me, Madam
Thank
Chair,
you.
Representative Van Orman.
Correct.
Thank you. Thank you both very much. Next we have David McKay, Bruce Lathers, and Chris Dudley, please. And if you're here for the puppy mill hearing, that does not start until 3 o'clock, but it will be a great hearing, I'm sure. Welcome.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is David McKay, and I'm the director of the Project Solutions Group at Willamette ESD, and I'm coming in support of 2013. Also, as a member of OFSM, of the Oregon School Facility Managers Association, and I come from a unique perspective. I'd like to share that perspective with you initially, is that Willamette ESD has a group of owners project managers that assist school districts in managing their construction projects statewide, and one of the largest projects we manage is the Senate Bill $1149, a public purpose purpose dollars that flow to school districts to do energy conservation projects. So I have a team of builders, construction project managers, that are assisting districts literally statewide from corner to corner and managing 80 school districts, 370 buildings, campuses throughout the state, and so have a pretty good pulse of the needs in school facilities. I come from the state of Washington prior, where we did have state match to assist school districts with their capital projects. And as I came to Oregon, began to understand that especially the rural districts, medium and small rural districts, have a very difficult time passing bonds to be able to do the capital improvements that they need. And so this bill, I think, is the first necessary step for us to begin to study that, analyze that, and to come forward with recommendations. The other thing that I find that is difficult is that there is no comprehensive building assessments. There is no one group that has assembled a comprehensive building assessments to give us a true state of conditions of buildings throughout the state. And that has two aspects of it. One is we really define well in the bill, looking at the buildings architecturally, electrically, mechanically, structurally, civilly, through the site. But then there's also the capacity study. And there's many people who look at capacity and utilization in a number of ways, but it has to be driven by the educational program that is served in those buildings. And so I think it is this bill lays out well the steps that are needed for us to really have a true assessment of the buildings that is conducted by professionals, a group that can come in and really give us an assessment of the state of buildings, for the overall systems of the buildings, and also to give us capacity numbers that are driven by educational program. And I believe that the best way is to use the qualified educational model, and that's a model that we use as we do capacity studies, as the key component to then determine capacity and assessments of the buildings. And so we're urging your support here so that we can come forward with good recommendations, not only the assessment and the capacity of the buildings, but also to come forward with recommendations for some way to fund this. And one of the arguments that I've heard over and over again is that, you know, there just hasn't been a good way to do that. And Washington, you know, was thoughtful, and in the 40s they've set aside dollars to be able to assist districts with their capital construction, and they have a state match that is based upon the geographic and the economics of the community. You know, what do we do now? And as I network with other construction managers around the nation, and I talk to them about what they're doing, and most states do have some type of state match. Ohio, who used to be known for the very worst facilities in the nation, about 5 or 6 years ago, found a way to generate an equitable state match to be able to rebuild their buildings in the state of Ohio, and they've done a very successful job. And so I believe that there are ways that we can do this. And I think that this facility task force, the building assessments, the capacity study, and that group then coming forward with some opportunities is a great first step for us to address the tremendous needs that we have in facilities throughout the state. Thank you.
Thank you.
Me next?
Yes, please. And if you'll start by introducing yourself, that would be great.
Madam Chair, my name is Chris Dudley. I'm co-chair of the Center for Innovative Schools. I've been retired from full-time employment for 5 years. Before that, I was 30 years with the School Boards Association and as a registered lobbyist here, and I've seen some school issues in my day. The Center for Innovative School for Innovative Schools is a nonprofit organization in this state that's purpose is to help school districts and school officials in their school building and school siting decisions in an effort to get community-centered schools, raise questions about whether renovation is as good an alternative as new buildings, green issues, etc. And from that standpoint of a nonprofit that's dealing with those issues, have two. I want to say our board has supported House Bill 2013. We think you should get it down to Ways and Means where it can be staged for the ending decisions about who gets funded here, because this is a very, I support the testimony before me, this is a very needed issue. Just 2 points I want to bring to this. From our standpoint, Representative Maurer's point about at the time the stimulus package was being discussed and trying to identify the shovel-ready projects in Oregon schools that might be in line for that money. We found some frustration in trying to help other organizations identify that, and there just isn't, as you pointed out, a centralized way of getting that information in our state. And secondly, we're involved right now in with our partners, the 21st Century School Fund in Washington, D.C., and the Oregon Association of Education Service Districts, in a pilot project that is attempting to, or is going to facilitate a school management software for districts to use with up to 550 data points per building. And that is a pilot project. And that's not anywhere near statewide, but there's 20 districts that are starting to participate in that. And we see this this effort in 2013 as a really good partner in that effort to get consistent definitions and a broader look at what the real needs are. And hopefully down the road we would see these two efforts coming together. So with that, I just want to again express our support for House Bill 2013.
Thank you very much.
Madam Chair, committee members, my name is Bruce Lathers. I am the manager of construction services for the Salem-Keizer School District, and under that umbrella falls the $242 million bond program management, which our community passed this fall. My background is I retired out of the Navy in 1996, and I went to work at Glide School District as the maintenance repair person, which was the maintenance department in Glide. I worked there for about 18 months, and then I became the manager of facilities or director of facilities for the Roseburg School District. Glide's 1,000, Roseburg is 7,000, and then I was came to the Salem-Keizer School District in June of 07 as part of their team to put together the bond measure that we went after and were successful in November. So I have experience on assessments, or I've seen assessments for three different size school districts throughout the state, and I can say very clearly that the assessment systems and all three districts were significantly different. In Glide, the assessment sat in somebody's head, normally the maintenance person's head. It wasn't documented. It wasn't written down anywhere. And they had nothing that would resemble a long-range facilities plan. In the Roseburg School District, we did document and assess our school district within the district. It was an in-house emphasis. It was created, it was developed, there was a maintenance bond passed, and about 5 years after that, a construction bond passed with an ongoing process. When I came to Salem-Keizer, again, Salem-Keizer had a fairly involved long-range facilities plan. However, one of the first jobs was to assess the district to determine what repair work was needed and should be included in our bond. In that bond, we did include $114 million of repair and renovation work. But the first job I had was to do that assessment and come up with that list of work and get it into the bond. It was pretty fast-tracked. It was interesting and hard to do. However, we were fairly successful in that. The point of going through that is, and the reason I'm speaking in favor of 2013, is a commonality of assessment throughout the state of Oregon will allow a reasonable priority for all our school districts to then stage the maintenance in the proper method and manner needed that best helps those dollars spent assist or create better student achievement, which is what our facilities are about. So I just encourage you support this bill.
Thank you very much. Are there any questions for this panel? Seeing none, thank you very much. Next we have Dr. Katrina Hedberg, please.
Thank you.
Welcome.
Thank you. Chair Gelser and members of the committee, good afternoon, and it's my pleasure to be here. For the record, I'm Dr. Katrina Hedberg. I'm the interim state epidemiologist for the Public Health Division of the Department of Human Services. And I want to talk today about House Bill 2013, which would establish a school facilities task force. And specifically, I'd like to propose a public health representation on this facilities task force, and also that the task force assessments include a health assessment of the school facilities, where schools are sited, and whether they're renovated, those types of things have a major impact on whether kids are able to walk and bike to school, getting enough physical activity, and also issues around air quality, I think was addressed earlier, which can have an impact on asthma exacerbations among school kids as well as other respiratory conditions. In Oregon, there's more than 560,000 school-aged children that go to public school and more than 33,000 adults that are employed by public schools, and they spend an awful lot of time in these school facilities. So we believe strongly that school facilities really need to provide a supportive environment where health can be promoted. Oregon is in the middle of an obesity epidemic, and the children are infected by the epidemic as well. Obesity is associated with serious health conditions like diabetes, asthma, high blood pressure. And Oregon kids, 1 in 5 are overweight or obese. This proportion has tripled over the past 20 years. This current generation of Oregon school kids is now projected to have a shorter life expectancy than preceding generations due to this obesity epidemic. So the increase in obesity is very simple. Too many calories going in and not enough physical activity or calories being used. And school environments play a big role in how much physical activity kids get, both while they're in school, but also whether or not they can walk or bike to school. So we would strongly support that bike racks, sidewalks, those kinds of things are are part of school grounds so that kids are able to walk or bike to work to school. I also mentioned the health, the respiratory illness. Schools that are sited near freeways or highways or where buses can idle, those kinds of things can have an effect on the air quality and, again, exacerbate asthma in school kids. Approximately 10% of Oregon 8th graders and 11th graders report having asthma, which could be exacerbated by this. So in summary, the Health Division recommends that House Bill 2013, that the task force would include a public health representation, as well as that the task force address some of the health impacts that facilities have. However, this is not in the governor's recommended budget, so we support the policy but are neutral on the budget, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Okay, thank you. Are there any questions? Seeing none, thank you. And then we also have Andrea Salinas with a quick addition to the testimony. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Andrea Salinas. I'm the Legislative Director with the Oregon Environmental Council. OEC recognizes the importance of Oregon children having functional, safe, and healthy learning environments. 5 days a week, close to 20% of Oregonians spend their days at a school, and many school buildings are old, in poor condition, and have environmental factors that actually inhibit learning and pose risks to the health of the children and the staff. The duties set before the task force cover many important aspects of school facilities. We believe the charge to the task force would be strengthened by assessing the environmental quality of schools, indoor air quality, ventilation, lighting, and increased focus on not only energy efficiency within the schools, but also other aspects of high-performing schools, including water efficiency and the types of materials used in construction projects. Most schools are built and remodeled to meet building codes, but are not designed to provide comfortable, productive, and healthy work environments for students and faculty. High-performing schools are built buildings and facilities that create healthy environments that are conducive to learning while saving energy, water, resources, and money. High-performing, low operating costs, and reduce or eliminate negative impacts on the environment and human health. Studies have shown that high-performing schools provide a range of significant benefits, including better student performance, increased ability to attract and retain teachers, and an improved image in the community. Many Oregon schools have already incorporated high-performing school features. One of these schools, Ash Creek Intermediate School in Monmouth, saw student absenteeism reduced by 15% after students moved into the new high-performing schools. I've included suggested additions with an amendment that we would like for your consideration, and thank you.
Thank you very much. Are there any questions? Seeing none, thank you very much. Is there anyone else that would like to be heard on House Bill 2012 or 2013? Seeing none, I'm closing the public hearing on House Bill 2012 and House Bill 2013. And I am opening a work session on House Bill 2533. Colleagues, we had a discussion about House Bill 2533 a couple of months ago. To refresh your memory, this was about remote and necessary school districts. It's a bill that Representative Huffman brought to us. Since that time, Representative Buckley, who's the co-chair of Ways and Means, came and requested that we get this bill moved on so that Representative Comp's committee can have a discussion about it in May during the policy bill conversations. In the meantime, because this is a complicated story, Representative Barnhart pointed out that state school fund bills appropriately go through the Revenue Committee, and he would also like to see the bill. So today, what I would like for us to do is move the bill without recommendation to Revenue so that it has time to hear the bill so that it may get the bill to Representative Comp on time for a discussion in the Ways and Means Committee. Is there a motion?
I do have a motion, Madam Chair. I'd like to move House Bill 2533 without recommendation to the floor to be referred to Revenue and then to Ways and Means by prior reference.
Thank you. Representative Dimbrough moves House Bill 2533 to the floor without recommendation and that it be referred to the Committee on Revenue and the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference. Is there any discussion? Representative Huffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I want to thank this committee for hearing this bill and indulging me with it, and I will continue tracking this through its various committees to make sure that it it keeps its legs and keeps moving. Representative Buckley was astute enough to understand the law that we had discussed here in committee that day about the mandate constitutionally that we must educate or provide a public education to every child in Oregon, and so he felt it was incumbent upon the legislature to at least take a look at the fiscal, and so I trust that every step along the way, it's going to be in good hands. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative. And there is the fiscal impact statement. Does everyone have a copy of that? Is before you. It is a $4.4 million general fund appropriation. This should be a piece of cake. Representative Comp.
I find this conversation very interesting, and thanks Chair Gelzer and Representative Huffman. Whenever we talk about another component of what's the need for education, I'm sure this will be a lengthy discussion, and it will get all due respect for the need. It's an important discussion.
Thank you. Thank you all very much. So there is a motion on the table. Is there further discussion? Is there any objection to the motion? Seeing none, so ordered. And I will close the work session on House Bill 2533 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2558. Kevin, will you give us a brief rundown of House Bill 2558?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, give me 30 seconds to shift gears here. Before you is House Bill 2558. This matter would prohibit an elementary school from qualifying as a remote, and a remote small elementary school if it's within 8 miles by the nearest traveled road from another elementary school in the same district, unless there is a physiographic condition that makes transportation to another school not feasible. It does permit a school to qualify, however, as a remote small elementary school if the location of the school has not changed since January 1st, 1995, and if the school is qualified as a remote small school on the effective date of this measure. It does permit the school to qualify as, it also allows for the school to qualify as a small high school if the location of the school has not changed since January 1st, 95, and the school qualified as a small high school on the effective date of the measure. This does declare an emergency and provides that the amendments to the measure apply to the state school fund distributions commencing on the 2009-2010 distribution.
Thank you. And before we call the first panel up, this bill, like the last one, has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. The Revenue Committee did flag this as something that needed to go to the Revenue Committee. So I believe we have a letter coming from the Speaker that is changing that subsequent referral to Revenue as opposed to Ways and Means. So our panel is Billy Joe Smith, Brian Flannery, and Jim Chambers. I know there are five of you, but only three of you will fit at the table. So the first three of you, and then I'll bring the next two of you up after that. Welcome.
Thank you. Chair Gelser and members of the committee, I want to thank you for your interest in House Bill 2558, which updates the waiting funding formula for small schools. And I know that many of you are from small school districts and have small schools in your areas, and you understand firsthand how important this bill is. My name is Billy Joe Smith. I'm from Toledo, Oregon. I am chair of the Central Coast Stanford Children Chapter, a retired educator, and a former member of the school board for Lincoln County Public Schools. I'm testifying in support of House Bill 2558, and I'm most familiar with the high school portion of the bill. It applies really right now to four high schools in Oregon, which, due to declining enrollment since 1999, have fewer than 350 students in grades 9 through 12 at this time. Toledo Junior Senior High School is in my school district. The other schools are Riverside Junior Senior High in Boardman, Coquille High School, and Pleasant Hill High School. These schools were in the same location in 1995 and well before. They are in districts with less than 8,500 ADMW, as the current law requires. Another important factor is that these are the only high school in the towns where they're located. The viability of these high schools at this time is seriously threatened, and they deserve this weighted funding along with the other 102 small high schools which qualified prior to 1999. Even with the inclusion of these four additional schools, the small school weighted revenue distribution is still less than 1.5% of the school distribution formula revenue. Information was developed through the 2007-08 report for the Revenue Committee by the State of Oregon Legislative Revenue Office. My goal today is really to provide you with some background research study information which clearly supports two things. One, the policies which provide justification for weighted funding formulas to create equity for small rural schools. And the second, that maintaining small rural schools is vital because of their benefits for students and the communities. A lot of this is obvious to us, but I think it is useful, and I learned a great deal from reading some of these studies that really verified and provided some background information in this area. I will tell you that many of the references I make are reports done by the Rural School and Communities Trust, and all of them are available online, and I've included the website address for that. You would just look at that and look for their publications. The other is your own report, A Student Waits for Small Schools, the research report by the State of Oregon Legislative Revenue Office, and that is on your own website. And the other, the SAFET report, was done for Jim Torrey when he was the mayor in the city of Eugene in 2003, and two pages with an excerpt from that report make up the second page of the document that I handed you, just because that one isn't readily available, but I will not be reading that to you by any means. the first premise, that support for weighted funding policies to provide educational equity and mitigate the higher per student costs of small schools is indeed verifiable. And the first study there, Breaking the Fall, Cushioning the Impact of Rural Declining Enrollment, is a report that provides 15 policies that are recommended for states and 5 district level actions relative to the funding of small schools and schools with the declining enrollment. And the recommendations are basically focused on funding formulas, and they support what Oregon is doing, which is pretty good, except for one part, which is we have a cutoff date for the inclusion of newly small schools. And so that's the part that we're asking you to remedy today with the House bill. The second study, Student Weights for Small Schools, your study, describes the history and current use of the funding formulas in Oregon. It has also 14 policy options available, and 2 of them apply directly to House Bill 2558, the one to update or eliminate prior qualification date and to allow certain schools with declining enrollment to qualify. The second major idea, which is a question that comes up a lot, why not just consolidate? And basically, the studies show that the benefits of maintaining small rural schools outweighs the cost of savings of consolidation for both the educational success of students and the economic and social health of the communities. The first thing I will cite there is the Hobbit effect. Again, it's called Why Small Works in Public Schools, and it's through the Rural School and Community Trust, and it presents 10 basic reasons why small schools work for students, and I'm not going to name them all, but a few. Greater participation in extracurricular activities occurs in small schools, and that is directly linked to academic success in those schools. Small schools are safer, kids feel more comfortable, they feel like they belong, the small class sizes allow more individualized instruction, good teaching methods are easier to implement, and they have more mixed ability classes so that all students basically have respond to higher expectations. Small schools, it's interesting to think that, for example, the Gates Foundation is advocating breaking large schools into small schools for the very reasons that small schools have these incredible benefits. Yet we have so many small schools in Oregon, and we really need to look at them carefully and support them because they are so valuable. The second report is the SAFET report, Securing Adequate Funding for Educational for Education Task Force from Eugene in 2003. And this has some really interesting findings in it, at least they were to me. And the section of the study I gave you is a part of the piece on benefits and costs of consolidation. And it concludes that while per pupil costs are higher in small rural schools than in other schools, the expenditures are a relatively small part of the state's expenditures on schooling. Consolidation of school districts might produce a few cost savings, and in some cases none, depending on the size of the school district. You will see that in the report. But the negative effect of such consolidation on students and rural communities is thought to be substantial. I will name just a few of the other important learnings from the report. Students are more satisfied with small schools, and the dropout rate is lower than in that of larger schools. When individual characteristics are equalized, students in small schools have higher academic achievement. This one was particularly interesting. The negative effect of poverty on academic achievement is sharply reduced for students in schools with fewer than 301. I don't know why that number came up, but 301 students. The beneficial effect of small schools comes through the more personalized attention that the students receive, stronger feelings of community, and the more orderly atmosphere that is found in those schools. It also talks about the effect of long bus rides on students, particularly if they're extended over 30 minutes, which, of course, in some of our rural communities, we just can't avoid that. But the effect is that it affects students' achievement. The participation in extracurricular activities is limited. The time students spend with their families is reduced. And the ability of parents to become involved in the schools, which is so critical to student success, is limited by those long rides. They're also, it verifies some of the economic outcomes in communities and say that it is related to the social connections that schools promote. The next article, again, or the report, comes from through the Rural Education Community Trust. And this is the role of education promoting the economic and social vitality of rural America from 2005. And this is a report of 9 articles dealing with this topic. And I, pardon me, selected one of them, which I found particularly of interest. And it just relays a few case studies of findings relative to the relationship in the rural school and communities. It says, rural schools serve as symbols of community autonomy, community vitality, community integration, personal control, personal and community tradition, and personal community identity. Of all civic institutions in a village, the school serves the broadest constituency. Schools meet the educational needs, are a source of employment, and provide social, cultural, and recreational opportunities. And this one is particularly of influence. It particularly hit me. Viable villages generally contain schools. Dying and dead ones either lack them or do not have them for long. The capacity to maintain a school is a continuing indicator of a community's well-being. I now understand why the OSU economist who worked with the city of Toledo on economic planning a few years ago said this: whatever you do, don't ever give up your high school. It's critical to your community's future. So please support House Bill 2558 and all the wonderful values Oregon's small rural schools provide to their students and their communities. And thanks for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Brian Flannery. I'm the principal of Toledo Junior Senior High School, and I'm here to talk to you in support of House Bill 2558. Thank you for hearing us today. I want to talk about what the impact is on our school. Our school district, Lincoln County School District, is a great example of the impact of the support that's received from the small schools. One of our schools, Walport, we're in 4 different areas: Walport, Lincoln City, Newport, and Toledo, very distinct areas. And one of our schools, Walport, has been receiving the funds since 1999 and has allowed them to maintain a very high level of education there. They've won awards, this type of situation. Next year, our school will be within 15 students or so, 10 to 15 students of the same size as Walport, but will not receive that funding. And so even within our own school district, you can see where that inequity happens right now because of the way that the current law reads. We're seeing also the fact of what's happening with the decline in our enrollment and the decline in how much funding that we're receiving. You're seeing the stability is being lost with what we can offer in our school. This is what the bill really provides for the school, is that you know that you're not going to drop below a certain level. For our school, we had to cut back last year in our budget, and we're having to cut back again for next budget. And the best case scenario for us for next year is going to be approximately $500,000 reduction for us. And what that means is 4 out of our 16 teachers at the high school level will have to be cutting 4 positions, which is huge. You can imagine. When I was listening earlier to the discussions about libraries, I thought what a great thing would be to be able to have a librarian. And right now what we're working on is trying to have enough teaching staff in order to offer, I wouldn't say a comprehensive education, but an education that approaches that allows us to send kids onto higher education. That's our struggle. And that's what this bill will allow us to do, is have the stability to offer that in the future. Without this, we're looking at a loss of our school. And I can tell you, to just give you a picture of what this has meant for our community, is going to community meetings and talking about the budget, and then people being worried, generations of families that have gone to this high school wondering if we're going to have a high school next year, going in front of my student body and talking to them about that we are going to have a high school. If there's any way that we can have a high school next year, we're going to have it, because it's the rumor that around town is that we're closing down, and we're doing everything within our power to stay open, because it's not just about this school. It's about the community. I'll just give you a real quick example. As far as I come from a large city. I come from Columbus, Ohio. Somebody's talking about Ohio earlier. It's like, I'm glad they're doing better with their facilities. That's good. But I went to a school of about 1,600 people, and I didn't know half the people in my graduating class. In moving to Corvallis from Ohio, I moved to Corvallis first, and I thought I understood what small town living was like until I came to Toledo. Now I really understand. And it is about the personalization. It's about the relationships that you form. And I can tell you that it's not just a school that will be lost. It will be a community. Over the summer, thousands of hours were put in by my community to put in new irrigation systems in our football fields, our softball fields. They repainted our gym. Just amazing, the outpouring of support that we've received from the community. And they come every weekend to our games. They come to all of our activities. It's really what our community is about. And I think that you need to keep in mind, as far as consolidation, I think in these times that we're facing right now in the economy, that what's going to be very important is that togetherness, the support that you see in a small town, is what everybody is going to be facing in this country to be able to get through and weather this time. So I hope that you support our bill and help us out. Thank you.
Chair Gessler, members of the committee, Jim Chambers. I'm not a school board member or anything of that nature. I'm a member of the community of Toledo, and I've spent the past 14 years as either a counselor or past mayor, and now I've got out of politics, so I thought. But the interesting part is, you know, I've heard a couple of things here tonight. One of them was a community-centered school, and, you know, I quickly wrote that down because I think that's what Toledo offers the students at that in that small town, is a community-centered school. It's a community that gets behind things. It's a community that makes things go. For example, we not only see members of our community volunteer for things like grad night and work-study opportunities, sports, and visiting artists and things to that nature, but we also see the students get involved with our town. We see our students do landscaping projects, video productions for our town, our businesses, our agencies. We see our city government offering summer reading programs, which is interesting. Like when I was mayor, we happened to get a rather substantial donation, and we recognized that that was important to the community. We recognized that what we wanted to do with that was establish a long-term basis for our summer reading program. And that's where we spent part of that money. We set that aside, and it'll never be spent for anything other than that. And I'll tell you, our librarian is very precious with that. But this is a partnership, and this is what makes for a viable community and for viable schools. I've seen the results of this school. My kids attended Toledo High School. My kids went on to college. My kids got a master's degree. And they're both successful in what they're doing. But what's really interesting is the fact that they both want to come back to the community. And, you know, this is what every community in Oregon wants. They want their students, they want their kids to come back and become part of the workforce, become part of the community. I'm happy to say that one of them has come back and is successful elementary kindergarten teacher and probably the best in Lincoln County. And I know my son will make it soon. But Toledo High School has been there for a long time. And I saw where that was part of the requirements. My wife's side of the family, which I'm happy to say, has four generations now of relatives that have graduated from that school. And so it shows you the long-term effect of that school on the community. When someone moves to Lincoln County, you know, they're looking at several things.
Mr. Chambers, I'm going to have to ask you to summarize because we have about 10 minutes and about five more people.
I can do that because I've also got a parking ticket probably.
In summary, when someone moves to Lincoln County, they look for several things, and one is a job, housing, and good schools. And Toledo offers every one of those. We have one of the largest family wage job employers, Georgia Pacific. We offer affordable housing away from the coastal area where the price of the housing is very heavy and costly. And schools, we have good schools. And we take a lot of pride in our schools. One thing that, and I'm cutting this short, one thing I can say is the fact that Toledo High School has produced students that have gone on college and have succeeded in life at a higher rate than the rest of the county schools. And I think that speaks high for a small school. In summary, children in schools are the backbone of every community, and I think that I can really see the value of House Bill 2558 and ask for your support of it.
Thank you very much. Are there questions for this panel? No, I actually have a quick question. What do you have a sense of what the amount of difference in state school funds grant would be to Toledo High School? What's the amount of money we're talking about that's making the difference for survival for you?
The amount that this bill would provide, yes, for us would be somewhere in the range of $600,000, okay, which would offset the cuts. But what we're really facing, what the big one of the large issue here is that we're talking best case scenario. When I say $500,000 cut and four teachers lost, that's a best case scenario. We can just get by possibly on that. But when we're looking at further, and that's what we're looking at, further cuts, this will help to stabilize us.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Our next panel is Rod Cross, Brenda Brown, and Amy England.
Madam Chair, as they're coming up, I also have a school that would be covered under this bill, but it would be an elementary school. And on page one, it inserts on line 23, inserts some language in the same school district. We have a school that is close to a district boundary, but it's 5 miles away from another elementary school, but it's in a school district, so the kids don't have the option of going to that other school district. So this bill is kind of a catch-all for a number of issues.
Representative Maurer, this is kind of a repeat of a bill I had introduced last session in the Corvallis School District. When I was on the board, we had to close a school that was in precisely that same situation, and it would have survived had this bill been in effect, but it is no longer there. It was the last country school in that county. That was in a bill. Please.
It's not my district. Chair Gelsel and members of the committee, my name is Rod Cross. I'm the current mayor of Toledo, Oregon.
Hey, there you go.
But more importantly for me to be here is that I'm the father of five school-aged children, ages 6 to 13, all boys, and all diehard boomers. And for those of you that don't know what a boomer is a fierce mountain beaver. In case anyone ever asks, now you have the answer to that question. I would like to impress upon you that as mayor and as a father, this is of vital importance to our community. This school impacts, and whether or not it's here in Toledo, impacts our community through many, many levels. It is vital for the vitality of our community, not just in the education process and the ability for our students to be schooled closer to home, closer to their families, so that it's much easier on families that way. Also for our civic pride. As former Mayor Chambers mentioned, our students at Toledo High School do a lot of things within our community. They build ties, not just with their parents and their neighbors, but with store owners, with people who run the construction businesses, with people who run the boat building businesses. That's where they do their job shadows. That's where they learn how to work, as they come in and they work with our members of the community. And, you know, in this day and age, you can't help but, whether it's on the internet, on the front page of the paper, or to lead the evening news, you hear about economic stimulus packages. This is the big one. this is it. Because if the school goes away, it's not just a loss of the school, it's an entire loss of a community. Because people don't ask you more, they ask you more of where you went to school than where did you grow up. And I don't want to have Toledo become one of those communities that is constantly looking somewhere else and is slowly dying away because parents don't want to live 10, 12 miles from their kid's school. They'd like to live around the corner, and they can do that in Toledo now. Our city has a close working relationship with Toledo High School. We provide, even though the school currently sits outside our city limits, we provide the majority of the police efforts with the school, which is, we have an outstanding working relationship with Principal Flannery and his staff. Also, our city, we adopted along with the school district the excise tax, the ability to use that because we've seen the need for it. We want to continue to work with the school district because we see it as an economic engine just as much as a major employer such as Georgia Pacific is. This school is an economic engine in our community. And I know time is short, so I will sum up again. The vitality of the community of Toledo is dependent upon this school. It is vital to the civic growth, it is vital to the educational growth, and it is vital to the economic growth of our town. When people come in to look at Toledo, they look to see, do we have a job? Well, where can my kids go to school? What kind of livability do they have? And the school is vital to that livability. And I urge you to vote yes on 2558. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And I'm going to ask you both to be as brief as possible.
I'm going to be very brief. I'll read this so I can zoom through it and not miss anything, and I'd be happy to take questions at the end if you'd like. Chair Gelser and members of the committee, thank you for hearing our testimony today and considering our input regarding small remote schools and making your decision on House Bill 2558. It's a very difficult but major decision.
Can you state your name for the record, please?
Oh, I'm sorry.
That's okay.
Next line, my name is Brenda Brown. I'm the proud parent of two very successful Toledo High School graduates, as well as a very successful exchange student graduate and several other children I've worked with. I'm a member of the local chapter of Stanford Children, and I currently serve on the Lincoln County School District Board of Directors. So I'm very familiar with the needs of our entire district. Lincoln County School District is somewhat unusual in that it is comprised of four very distinct and distant communities. Each of these communities has one single high school in its community. We, along with many other districts, have struggled for many years to keep our programs intact to prepare our students for success. The economic downturn and decreasing enrollment is affecting our small schools most severely to the point of impacting their very viability. Specifically for Lincoln County, that would be Toledo Junior Senior High School, which I think you probably get. The school funding formula in Oregon has been designed to establish equity among our schools. The Oregon legislature has recognized the need for extra funding for schools, school districts with small schools since at least the 1940s by granting additional revenue to help provide an educational program that meets state standards in small schools throughout the state. There are four small high schools in Oregon that now qualify for this needed support but do not receive it simply because their enrollment was slightly above the required number on October 23, 1999. It doesn't seem right that a school with declining enrollment is not adequately funded simply because it wasn't small before a prescribed date. The changes set forth in House Bill 2558 would not require new dollars, but is a redistribution of funds. There are currently one...
And Brenda, I'm going to have to ask you to summarize.
Okay. It's really a redistribution of funds, so it won't hurt large districts any more than it does any other district, including Lincoln County, who also contributes to funding of small remote schools. So
I'll just end by thanking you for listening, asking for your recommendation for support and passage of House Bill 2558. I think you've heard very clearly that it is vital to Lincoln County and Toledo Junior Senior High. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And while Amy's starting, if Alex Kyler and Peter Tarzi want to move up close to the front of the room, we'll get everybody in the next 4 minutes.
Chair Gelser, members of the committee, my name is Amy England, and I am here representing Coquiel School District in Coos County. I am a math and science teacher at Coquiel High School. You have a written version of my testimony, so I will try to summarize. Coquiel has dwindled below the number of a small district for the last 5 years. We've seen severe cuts because of it. The bottom line is there's no more places to cut. And at the high school level, what we are seriously facing right now is not being able to offer the courses that our students need to even be accepted into a four-year university. We can do what's required for graduation diplomas, but if we cut everything else, there is not that option. And one of the major goals that we have is for all of our students to be able to take that next step in their careers. Like these people, you have very much a view of our community, similar situation, similar interests. The difference for us would be currently about $340,000 from this bill, which would save programs and allow us to continue. Does not solve all of our economic problems, but would be very, very significant and a very small cost statewide. Thank you for accepting our testimony. If you have any questions, I'd be glad to take them.
Thank you all very much. And I'm so sorry for the rush. We're at the end of the hour, and I'm told there are about 250 people standing outside those doors. So I'm going to invite Alex and Peter to come in and ask you all to be careful. As you walk out, there will be a flood of people concerned about puppies coming in the door. Yes, please.
Chair Gelser, members of the committee, I'm Alex Kyler. Some of you may know me as the Intergovernmental Relations Manager for Lane County, but I'm going to take that hat off for a second and speak to you as my position of volunteer member of the Budget Committee in Pleasant Hill School District in Pleasant Hill, and I've submitted a letter from our superintendent. I would just echo everything that's been said here, and I'd urge you just to, as swiftly as you can, to schedule this bill for referral to revenue. My understanding is it's got several different committees it's got to get through yet. My other comment is this, is that the frustrating thing about watching small schools, especially Pleasant Hill, which has just been this incredible community center, as people have expressed about their schools, it begins to get into a spiral that I'm afraid we won't get out of. And that's one of the things that this bill will help us sort of grasp onto something as a glimmer of hope here. But the worse it gets in terms of cutting programs, the more people have an incentive to take their kids elsewhere out of district, and that makes it all the more worse. And this is one measure that would really help, at least to help us slow that spiral, give us a little bit more time to do some things that are more substantial in nature. Thanks very much.
Chair Gelser, my name is Peter Tarzi, and I'm superintendent of schools at Falls City School District. I have been in Falls City since 1999 and have been an advocate of this measure since 2001. I think what I'd first like to say to you is if you want to look at a high school that has benefited from this additional support, because we were eligible in the 2009 change. It has been Falls City High School. It allows us to maintain highly qualified status for all of our staff. It allows us to support our students with technology. It allows us the ability to diversify what we offer our students, either by contracting with neighboring school districts to provide special seats in areas such as calculus or chemistry. It allows us to do a lot of things. What our dilemma is our elementary school did not qualify in 1995 when the statute was changed. And so as a result, you, from my point of view, this is a technical change for a statute that initially was thoughtful, but had some problems that people did not really foresee. One of those problems was, in other words...
Peter, I'm going to have to ask you to sum up there. They're coming for our seats.
All right. I would suggest that the value of the proximity of schools, such as Representative Maurer noted, is of no value if those schools are not in the same school district. And I would also suggest that the physical demographics in terms of those relationships change over time. A very purposeful reason to remove the date. And then lastly, I would suggest that in an elementary environment, it will allow us to lose our propensity for blends. This measure, if it were enacted, would produce for my elementary school of 95 students $347,650, which amounts to 20% of my total district budget. Thank you.
Thank you very much, and thank you for your patience. I'm sorry you were rushed at the end. Colleagues, it is my intention that we're going to move this bill on. It's a very important bill for these schools and for the small communities in the state of Oregon. Wednesday, we're meeting in Hearing Room A in joint session with the Senate on virtual schools. I'm closing the public hearing on House Bill 2588, and the House Committee on Education is adjourned. Be careful as you walk out the door.